Hey everybody, I'm Kai, and this is Corner Office. Thanks for taking the time to stream or download us. This episode comes from our archives, although not that far back in the archives. Back in April, I sat down with Sherry Lansing. She is the former CEO of Paramount Studios, and she was, for a good long while, the highest-ranking woman in the entertainment business in Hollywood. She presided over Forrest Gump, Braveheart, Titanic, Saving Private Ryan, a bunch of more. Very big deal in Hollywood land. Now she runs her own foundation, and I was talking to her because her authorized biography had just come out. It's a book called Leading Lady, Sherry Lansing and the Making of a Hollywood Groundbreaker, written by Stephen Galloway. Here it is, my conversation with Sherry Lansing.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Sherry Lansing, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What was it like at Paramount when you took over?
Well, when I took over, there had been an absence of a lot of films. So for want of a better word, the cupboard was kind of bare, which usually happens when a new person comes into the job.
So, and that's probably why a new person comes into the job,
usually,
right?
Usually, yes. Yeah. And it's not a reflection on the person who was there before me. He had had some personal issues, and they were dealing with the health of a child. So he couldn't focus as much as one has to focus in that job. So there were two things that I immediately wanted to address. And the first was the morale of the people that were there and the fear that everyone has when somebody new comes into a job. You always wonder, are you going to survive? And my philosophy has always been that you should give everyone who's there a chance. And you should see what they're like. You shouldn't just, you know, wholesale get rid of everybody just because you're new. You should give them a chance. And I'm happy to say that I kept everybody, and they really rose to the occasion. And so that made me feel good. I had worked with them before as a producer, so I knew a lot of them, but I had never worked with them as an executive. The other thing was, and the most important thing, was to find movies. Because no matter what the responsibilities of the job are, no matter how much you have to worry about the parking lot and the commissary and all the bureaucracies of running a studio, your success is simply determined by whether the movies succeed. And so our cupboard was pretty bare, and we set about trying to find movies to make. And I think you have about a year and a half of a runway to do that until you're judged on the movies that come out. My philosophy was a simple one. I believed in the producers. So we set about finding the best producers to come to our lot who weren't already under contract, and we counted on them to find the best material to be made into movies.
Let me back up for a minute and ask you about coming to L.A. in the early, mid-60s. You're like 20 years old. You come to be an actress and a model. You wind up teaching math in South Central Los Angeles.
Yes. I came to Los Angeles the day after I graduated college. I got in a car with my then husband, and we drove across country because he was going to be an intern at Cedars of Lebanon Hospital. And I had a dream. I had a dream to be in the movie business. And I really didn't know anything about the movie business because I know I sound like I came from another planet. I'm 72 years old. And at that time, there was, I think, only one film school. So I hadn't studied film. I'd gone to Northwestern, and I'd studied theater as well as English and math, and I had a degree to teach. Teaching is my second passion, and I love it. But my first passion was to be involved in the movie business. So I had to support myself. My husband had a very, very, very teeny income as being an intern at a hospital.
And he was working a zillion hours a week, I'm sure.
Working 24 hours a day, sometimes 36 hours a day without any sleep. And we can question whether that's good for the patient or not, but that's what you do when you're an intern. And, of course, there are a lot of other people surrounding the doctor, so he's not there alone. And I had a third dream, and it's funny because it all comes together at this point in my life. If I hadn't been a teacher, I wanted to be a social worker. So I wanted to work with underprivileged children. And that is why I chose to be a math teacher in Watson, East LA. because that combined my love of teaching, my love of math and English. I was both in high school, and I wanted to work with underserved students. And I had been active in that as a child, growing up in various charity works and through college.
And you get a job. So long story short, modeling and acting doesn't really pan out for you in a substantive way.
It's an understatement. I may be the worst actress that there ever was. I was painfully uncomfortable and painfully untalented.
But you become a story editor and then eventually a producer in Hollywood.
So I was very lucky. I was cast early, so that it was only a couple of years where I was trying to pursue. First, I was a teacher, and I taught for 3.5 years while I was getting modeling and / acting jobs. And then I got acting jobs after that. And they were, you know, relatively substantial. One was in a movie with John Wayne that Howard Hawks directed. Huh. And it was there that I realized, and unfortunately I realized it right away, that I was very uncomfortable as an actress. And I also didn't have any talent, but maybe that was why. But I couldn't do it. So I have the greatest respect for actors and actresses because I literally could not do it. I would get like this tension in my arms and legs. I felt inauthentic. I felt fake. I couldn't be somebody other than myself. They didn't like my accent. They didn't like my voice. They thought it was too high. So I used to have to talk like this, you know. And I just felt totally like a fake. But I looked around at everybody on the set. And that was the best education I could ever get. And I said, what are all these people doing? And I realized that there was somebody there whose responsibility was to follow the script. And I also realized that there were people that worked for production companies who read screenplays and then summarized them so the producer didn't have to do it himself. And fortunately, I had a college degree. I had an English degree. And I thought, wow, I can do that. I know how to read material. I know how to summarize it. And so I got a job working for an independent producer.
Do you think that's why you became as successful as you became as an executive in Hollywood? Because you knew, in essence, how to produce. You knew the whole thing, soup to nuts.
Well, I'm very grateful for the success that I have. And I couldn't answer that question, really.
Come on.
No, I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you. I worked very hard. I think I had a background in English, so I did have an ability to analyze material and to try and help the writers shape the material and find the sense of truth in it. And I had that from my background in English, and I also had it from my background, even though I was not very good as an actress. Sometimes writers would say to me, just read the scene. Try reading it with me. And I'd say, I can't act. And they'd say, no, but you'll know what's wrong. You'll know whether it's fake. I remember Jimmy Bridges said that to me once when we were working on the China Syndrome. And I read it, and we could discover the truth, what was missing, what was the essence. But I also want to be clear. There are a lot of talented people out there, and you need what we refer to in the movie business as the movie god to shine on you. You need luck. And I was blessed with luck as well as hard work, and I assumed talent to do the job.
There are many, many stories in this book and in all the reading I've done about you, of you being tough's not the right word, but very – I don't know. Maybe tough is the right word.
I hope
not. You're smiling a little bit. I mean, there are stories in here of you being able to – this is a quote from the book, hand somebody their head on a platter and make them go away happy about it.
Well, wow, that's a quote in the book.
Yeah.
I think that I was honest and I was direct. I think there are several things. First of all I cared about was the movies. I loved the movies that I was working on. And that is really important when you are working on a project and the producer, then the director and the actors and the cinematographer and everybody who's there knows that you care. And you care actually as much as they do. You just have a different role when you're running a studio. That means that when you give criticism, you give it to a group of people who you are on the same side of. You're all trying to do the same thing. And nothing is worse than somebody who kind of dances around and doesn't give you an honest response. And so if you know that the person who's the studio cares and really loves the movie and really is there with the same interest that you are, you may disagree. You may say, I don't agree with that, but at least you know you're coming from the same place. And those are called healthy disagreements. And sometimes I was completely wrong and I would change my opinion and I would go with what the filmmakers were saying. And sometimes they would say, well, let's try it. And sometimes a third thing would come out of it that none of us had ever thought of. So I also like to think that not only was I direct and passionate about the movies and caring about the movies, so therefore we were on the same side, but I also want to think that I was fair. Do you know, I tried very hard to collaborate, to listen, to be fair, to give every option a chance. When we would do test screenings of movies, everybody would watch the movie, and we would watch it in front of an audience. And I did not wait for the scores, which is, you know, the results of the screening, because I knew that, quote, that I was the executive, the chairman of the studio, the suit, which is the one word I never wanted to be. And I had come from a producing background, so I knew what it felt like, you know, to be sitting there watching a bunch of people watch your movie, which is like your child. You know, I knew what that felt like. And so I would always say to them, let's go back to my office. Let's not worry about the scores. I don't want to know the scores.
Well, you were pretty strict about this, right? You had to walk back to the office
and
directly.
No,
no
one
talking,
could talk.
Right?
Yeah. I didn't want anyone to influence anyone.
Right.
And then I would have everybody sit around and I would say, I am going to speak last because I do not want you to think that the executives in the room are just, you know, sucking up to me and trying to agree with my opinion. So everybody would go around and give their opinion of how they thought the screening went, whether they thought it was great, whether they thought it needed these changes, needed to more shooting, whatever it was. And I said, do not be afraid to give any opinion. There's no opinion that is bad. It's an opinion. And then I would speak last. And I remember I would always start it off by saying, okay, I'm going to give you my opinions. And then we're going to look at the scores. And if my opinion was that it needed a lot of work, which is fine. Some of the greatest movies need a lot of work, like, you know, like editing and changing to get to the final, you know, end, which is fine. That's what the test screenings are about. I used to say, then you can dine out. If I've given you all these notes and the scores are through the roof because I'm going to pay attention to that audience, then you can dine out on how stupid I was. And I don't mind that, do you know? But if, you know, the scores aren't so good and maybe the audience is saying the same thing, you'll know that it just came from my instincts and my heart. It wasn't coming from me reading the scores. And so that was, I think, an honest way. And sometimes I was the stupid one in the room. Sometimes I was like, I go, whoa, I mean, they loved it and I had problems. So I'm wrong. If, you know, 500 people love it, you know, maybe you want to tweak it a little, but I'm wrong. But, you know, if all of you love it and 500 people don't, then maybe we need to pay attention that our message isn't getting out. I wasn't adjusting it for the scores, but you want your message to get out. And I had gone through the process as a producer in two of the pictures that were the most rewarding and the most successful, The Accused with Jodie Foster and Fatal Attraction, where we were really helped by screening it. And our message, what we wanted, wasn't getting across to the audience. And so we adjusted. And I'm happy we did because in the case of The Accused, I mean, the first test screening of the movie was probably the worst in the history of Paramount Pictures. I mean, they actually thought that the Jodie Foster character deserved the rape. Well, that was clearly not what we wanted. Our movie was made, you know, for the exact opposite reason. And in the editing, of the movie, we had made a lot of mistakes. And it's not Jody's fault. She had given us all the right choices. We just had made mistakes. And when we re-edited it, it got among the highest test scores in the history of Paramount. And I think it had a great positive effect on rape victims so that they're not victimized twice, you know, first by the actual rape and then by, you know, the society that said that, you know, they asked for it, so to speak.
The list of movies that you either greenlighted at Paramount or were involved with as a producer is extraordinary. Forrest Gump, Braveheart, Titanic, Fatal Attraction, Private Ryan. Did you know
when
you came out of, for instance, the test screen?
So first of all, that's very kind of you. And I want to say that I certainly did not do this alone, that there was a team of people I worked with who I'm very grateful to. And I also want to say that the filmmakers deserve all the credit. When you're an executive—
Well, they get all the glory all the time, right?
And they get all the pain, and we get all the pain as executives too. But I want to say that I was thrilled to be able to collaborate and help those directors, producers achieve their vision. Did I know? So that's a double question, okay? There's not a movie that I greenlit that I didn't think would be a huge hit. So let's start with that. Why would I greenlight anything that I didn't think was going to be a huge hit? I believed in every movie. So every movie that failed, I believed in when I greenlit it as much as every movie that succeeded. And I also want to say I worked just as hard on the movies that failed as I worked on the movies that succeeded.
Does that gut you? That must gut you to see a movie fail.
I tell you, you can't get out of bed in the morning. I mean, I remember many a morning where you just kind of lie in bed and you want to pull the covers over your head and you cry. Sometimes real tears, sometimes just the emotional feeling of real depression and the feeling of, when you're a producer, the feeling of a failure, that you failed. When you're running a studio, I always felt that I let the filmmakers down, that it was my fault. And it was my fault because I felt that the studio has a responsibility to open the picture. That opening weekend is our marketing. And therefore, I let them down. And there were just times like I was depressed for days. And then the thing that you most need in this job, among many things, but the thing that comes to my mind right now is resiliency. You cannot wallow in this. You have to pick yourself up as a producer, as a director, as an executive, and you have to try again. And I believe it's Sumner Redstone that I read in his book, which stuck with me, that success is not built on success. It's built on failure and picking yourself up and trying again. And I think that's a really wise statement because we've all failed as much as we've succeeded, but the resiliency to pick yourself up and to go again is what keeps you going.
And especially in this industry, because it's not your best work, right? It's your last work
that everybody looks at. And that drives me crazy because you're literally judged on your last work and you should be judged on your best work. And it shouldn't be a business where, you know, if you've had, you know, six successes and one failure that suddenly you're in director jail or producer jail or whatever you want to call it. Everyone should be judged on their best work. And that's what we should talk about. So you asked the question, did I know when the test screenings were great? I had certainly high hopes. But then what's so amazing is then you have to sell it to the public. So there are pictures that had phenomenal test screenings, phenomenal, you know, in the 90s in the top two boxes. And the audience didn't come. The one that comes to my mind is Searching for Bobby Fischer. I love that movie. Yeah. I think we released it twice. I mean, you know, like, in case you didn't see it the first time. And they never came.
Yeah.
And they never came because we didn't have a way to market it. We didn't have a way to sell it. There are other pictures where the test scores aren't that good, but you can sell them. And so then they open to a great number and they do a lot of business. So it's not just the movie, unfortunately. And that's how I think the business has changed so much since I first got into it and since I was a kid. Because when I first got into the business, it was all about the movie. You opened a movie on a few screens, and then word of mouth kicked in. Marketing was important, but not that important. I don't remember talking much about it in the beginning, a little, but not a lot. And then word of mouth kicked in. You told your friend to see it. I told my friend to see it. And the picture went up the second weekend. Today, if you can't market it, with rare exceptions, and there are exceptions, there's always two or three every year, and they're usually independent art house films. Mm-hmm. If you can't market it, you can't, even if it's great, you can't get an audience in the theater. And then what happens, because they open on thousands of screens, the studio movies now, the picture goes down. If it goes down 50%, you have a party. You think it's wonderful. When I first started in the business, the picture went down 50%. That meant the picture was bad. And you didn't want to go out for a week. So the whole business has changed. Which doesn't mean it's changed for bad. It's just different. The good thing that happened, for example, with Bobby Fischer, which I'm using as an example, and there are many more, is these pictures have this huge afterlife.
Yeah.
So people are constantly coming up to me and saying, one of my favorite movies that you were associated with is Bobby Fischer. And I always say, where were you then? I needed you then. But it has such a huge afterlife that now enough people have seen it, you could probably do a sequel, do you know? Because it's like now it finds its audience in the afterlife.
Since you brought us up to now and today, and acknowledging that you've been out of the industry, in air quotes, for 10, 12 years now, what do you make of the changes in, I apologize for this word, content production, right? I mean, television now is the place to be, and movies, there are like three movies every year, and they're all huge tentpoles, and that's about it.
So I think it's a thrilling time to be in the business. And even though I left the movie business literally 11 years ago, I am still a huge fan. And when I say movies, I just mean entertainment. To me, it doesn't make any difference whether it's in the local theater or whether it's on my iPad or whether it's on my television. I'm talking about content. And content is spectacular. I am addicted to so many of these long-form television shows. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just saw my last episode of Homeland. I just watched Billions. Yeah. I mean, I'm addicted to these shows. I mean, Big Little Lies. I feel like these people are my friends. Do you know? I'm talking about them all the time. I also just went to see Going in Style, you know, last night, and I loved it. So what I guess I'm saying is there's so many opportunities for young filmmakers today to do content. So when I was growing up, if you didn't have a studio give you the money to make your movie, you couldn't do it. I say to young filmmakers today, you have an iPhone. Go make your movie. You don't need a lot of money. Go make your movie. Put it on YouTube. Put it on the web. It'll get found. And then who knows? Then you'll be the next person, you know, directing Batman. Do you know? I mean, you know, Spider-Man. These are also wonderful movies that I love. They're great fun to watch. They're big special effects driven movies. So I'm an eclectic film grower. I like all ranges of films, and I like them on all ranges of distribution, right, for want of a better word. I mean, you know, my iPad has just been wonderful for long trips in Europe. I watch 12 hours of a show. When I get off in customs, I'm holding my iPad in my hand. I'm giving the guy my sheet. He's going, put the thing down. I went, okay, but I just want to know what happens. I mean, these are great, and you can really dig deep into characters and explore. I mean, I can't keep up with the things I want to watch. I really can't.
There's a question I ask people who have moved on from that thing on which they built their career, but I kind of can't ask it of you, because there's a line in the book that says, you know, when you left, you were burned out and you were upfront about that and you were done. And you now have clearly found your passion in your foundation in philanthropy.
So I always had a dream that if I was lucky enough to be successful in life, and achieve my dreams emotionally and have financial security, that I wanted to give back. And so I always knew that my end goal would be to start a foundation and to give back. The zeitgeist had changed in terms of the movies that got me into the business, which were movies that were about character and where people talked. And it had moved, as you said, for the studios into tent poles. But certainly the independents were still making those kind of movies. So that really wasn't the main reason. The main reason was that I think life is about chapters. And I think for me, after, 30 years in the business, 12 years running a studio, almost the same amount being a producer, and then before that being an executive for almost the same amount, I think I was burnt out. And I think that I was repeating myself. I think the highs weren't as high, the lows weren't as low. The passion, which is the most important thing I had, was kind of moving to something else. And so for me, it was moving to cancer research because I lost my mother to cancer. It was moving to education because I'm a former math and English teacher. And it was also moving, and that's not initially what I started out with, which was Encore Careers. You know, as someone once said, rewire, don't retire. You know, and so when I left the movie business, I remember the first day that I came to the office that we're sitting in now, and it was like I had graduated from college. I felt like this young person again. I was 60 and a half. And I remember I felt like I was 20 years old because it was like in college and I had to learn about science. I was on the stem cell board. I had to have scientists draw pictures for me so I would understand it. And I felt like everything was new. And I think the secret, you know, providing you stay healthy to staying young is curiosity. And so for the last 10 years, they have been completely joyous, the happiest years of my life. And someone said to me, but you said that when you were a Paramount. I said, well, you're supposed to think that every time you're in is the happiest time of your life. And that's what I feel now because I'm learning new things every day. I'm not a scientist. Education, you know, as we all know, has a lot of problems. So we're working in the same schools that I taught in. And unfortunately, there hasn't been enough progress, and there isn't a level playing field for the kids, and that's not fair. They still don't have math teachers. They still don't have science teachers. They don't have books. We need to change that. And then I'm helping other people, you know, have a whole new career and reinvent themselves. So I don't know. I feel more authentic. I feel very alive. I don't have a boss. I get to do what I want to do. I also get to have that wonderful leisure time that I never had before. I get to have lunches with friends. I get to go on wonderful trips to other parts of the world. And I said once, I wish I could stay an extra day. Well, today I can. I can stay that extra day just because I love it and just because I want to be there. And I don't have to be on the phone for 4 hours a day, you know, dealing with a movie when I'm in Florence, Italy, which is one of my favorite places in the world. But I did love my time in the movie business. I want to be clear about that. And I'm very grateful to it. And I still love movies. And it was time for a change. And it's about chapters. I mean, life is about chapters. It's about choices. It's about rewiring, not retiring. It's about, I read something that the Harvard Business School once said. It says, every 10 years, you're supposed to replant yourself. I think there's a lot of truth to that because you learn new things, curiosity. So I feel very, very grateful and very blessed.
Jerry Lansing, thanks very much.
Thank you. It's great to be here. This was fun.
All right, that's it for today's episode. If you like what you heard, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us as well. Tell us what you think. Corner Office is produced by Bridget Bonder. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the general manager and senior vice president. We will see you next time.